Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. What does it mean to be a poor student on a rich campus? That question is at the center of a new book by Anthony Jack, an assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. In the book, The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students, Jack peels back complex layers of poverty, privilege, and inclusion. Elite universities, he writes, bend over backwards to admit disadvantaged students, but then once the students are there, they maintain policies that not only remind those students of their disadvantage, but even serve to highlight it. Anthony Jack joins me now in studio. Welcome to Radio Boston, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
So can we just start with a real basic question? Can you explain what you mean by the privileged poor? The phrase sounds like a contradiction.
It's an oxymoron, and it's purposely so. I want people to ask that exact question. How can someone be both privileged and poor? And it came up in my research that one half of the lower income black students, like myself, actually graduate from boarding day and preparatory high schools like Andover and Exeter. And so even though we come from impoverished backgrounds, we were very low income. Our parents tend to not have gone to college and work in low-wage jobs. We got access to private schools, but not just the private schools, but the experiences, the educational experience of the top 1%. Some schools allow study abroad programs. You have friends who come from very wealthy families, and sometimes you also get invited on those private jets or those summer vacations or those, you're the beneficiary of more than just the academic training that those schools provide. And so in some ways, like, they're privileged in that sense. And so I put them together, kind of like privileged poor, kind of invites that question: how can someone be both privileged and poor?
I see. And so you're sort of lumping yourself into that category. And fill us in a little bit. You told our Carrie Young recently that the neighborhood you grew up in was one that people would drive through sort of quickly, but you did also graduate from a selective private high school.
I did. When I was in high school, I'm a Head Start kid, and I went to public school my entire life. But my 11th grade year, I encountered a coach that wanted you to be an athlete student, not a student athlete. And that eventually led me to leave the school. And so I got a scholarship to Gulliver Preparatory in Miami. And that one year was like a boot camp for what Amherst College, which is where I went to undergrad, ended up being. I got introduced to wealth and privilege in a way that I did not see growing up. And in one respect, I heard the term hostel for the first time. And I had never heard, you know, people going around Europe and staying in these type of places. And backpacking through Europe was even something that was brand new to me. So I learned a lot. But also academically, there was something there, too, because I got introduced to office hours, even though the school didn't necessarily use the same exact terms. Teachers had to make themselves available to us 1 hour every day after school. And it was drilled in us that we should make use of that time. When I got to Amherst, I saw the exact same thing. And so a lot of it was, there were a lot of parallels between the two.
I see. So I'm glad you brought up the office hours term, because this is something you write about in the book that stood out to me. And maybe not so much for the privileged poor students, but for the doubly disadvantaged, which is another group that you tackle. You told the story about some of those students not knowing what the term meant. In fact, assuming the opposite.
The office
hours meant that's when the professor is in his or her office and not to be disturbed.
Yeah, no, it's true. Office hours, like many things on a college campus, is a very classed term. You probably heard the term office hours if you fall in one of three categories. Either your parents went to college, you went to a certain type of high school, or you took one of those, how can I put it? You had access to some kind of program that previewed it for you, either at one of the boarding schools, like doing a summer program or doing different things like that. And so office hours like fellowship and winternship and even syllabus, some of the most things that we take for granted are very, very class terms. And one of the examples that I use in the book is that at one college, a professor asked students, like, hey, why don't you visit me in my office hours? And the students actually responded, well, you told us that your office hours are from 2 to 4. That's the time that you should not be bothered because you're doing your work. Right. And so it was something that was lost in translation that had nothing to do with like English proficiency. It was something that these terms have operated on these college campuses, which are silos. Right. Because not everyone has access to them, that when you bring in new students, non-traditional students or however you want to frame it, there's a certain type of learning curve for both the institution as well as the students. And oftentimes the institution doesn't want to change to accommodate those new admits.
And a simple misunderstanding of a term like that can have real consequences,
oh, yeah.
right? Because, you know, part of the college experience is not only the in-class education you get, but it's also the networking, the social capital that you build when you leave. And yeah. if you're missing out on those opportunities because you misunderstand the term office hours, that sets you back.
Yeah. I mean, the question is, you know, I can write a letter of recommendation for a student who got an A in my class, and it could probably just say this person got an A in my class. But if a student comes to my office hours, I get to know the student on a personal level, why they want to take the class, why they came to college, what are their interests, and they serve as my research assistant. And then over time, they also, like, you know, watch my cats when I go on vacation or something like that, and they get to know me personally, I get to know them. Their letter looks very different. The example that I love to use is like the Rhodes Scholarship. You need upwards of 8 letters of recommendation to apply for that prestigious fellowship. How many people can actually say, I have 8 people, not only who can write for me, but who can write a very strong letter detailing my character, my work ethic, and my intellectual abilities in that letter? Like, and that may be, you know, a unique example, but this is the road to not only letters of recommendations and invitations to be someone's research assistant, but it's also when you need emotional support, when you need someone to go to bat for you because you had a misstep, right? To give you the benefit of the doubt. That is office hours or connections with faculty more generally is the road to those type of connections.
I want to ask you about another example you use in the book. And I should say that you interviewed more than 100 students, right,
yes.
at selective colleges for this. So you got a pretty good sample pool here. And one of the ones that stood out to me among the so-called privileged poor had to do with dining halls and school breaks. Fill me in on what that was all about.
Yeah, I think dining halls highlight the dining hall closures specifically highlight the difference between access and inclusion. Many universities have opened their campuses and offer generous financial aid packages. But those same universities, which I found only 1 in 5, actually keep their dining halls open during spring or Thanksgiving or different kind of recesses that colleges have.
And the assumption is, right, that our students they're going home or they're going on vacation.
Right. So they're going on vacation, they're going home for turkey during Thanksgiving, or they're going for fun in the sun during spring break. And the reality is many students become food insecure during those breaks. They have no idea where their next meal is coming from. And what students do is they make tough decisions about how to make ends meet. So some students, as one student told me, I go to Family Dollar and buy everything that I can afford that I can then microwave because he doesn't have a fridge to put his food in. Or some students steal food from their own dining halls, oftentimes with the help of cafeteria workers, to actually be able to have something to live off of or to bridge the gap between what they can buy and what they can steal. And that's literally built into the very structure of the college calendar.
So what's causing the cup to miss the lip here? I mean, in other words, you're getting the students onto your campus in the first place, but you're saying the infrastructure, the way the campus runs, isn't built for students who don't come from affluent families or families where their parents have gone to college. So are there some basic recommendations that could solve that issue?
I mean, there are some basic things, but I think what we really need to do is we need to question what we take for granted. I think universities, especially selective universities, have so long catered to people from wealthy families, and then when they did diversify, they typically diversified from students who went to wealth by admitting students who went to wealthy schools, both who are full pay and full scholarship. So they are slower than they should be in making that move from, again, access to inclusion, making intentional steps to not only promote belonging, but making sure that students make the most of their time. And some things as basic as one, as I will keep saying until I turn blue in the face, is defining office hours, because I think that puts people in a position to start thinking, and I hope anyone who reads my work begins to ask themselves, what else do we take for granted? Right. If we keep throwing around terms like office hours, but I met someone who had taught for 25 years and said, you know what, Tony, I never thought about actually taking that step and saying what I'm talking about. I always just say when they are. Right. And so those kind of moments. And yes, yeah, something as simple as opening the dining halls during break is another step. But there are many other things that we need to do, because I think colleges also need to understand just the prevalence of food and housing insecurity. So we actually know how many of our students are food and housing insecure, because it's a growing number. And Sarah Goetrob at Temple found that 2 out of 5 of our students, undergraduates across the country, are food insecure. So what does that actually mean? And then we actually have more and more colleges that need to actually study not just how prevalent the problem is, but what is the nature of it? Because I show that it can be episodic, happening around breaks, or it could be chronic. And that actually requires two different policy changes to address it. Food banks can address one versus openings and more university-wide things can address the other.
And in your work, what did you find is the effect on graduation? Because there can be, it's sort of two levels, right? I mean, right. It can be you come on and it can be the degree to which you feel comfortable on campus. And then there's the matter of whether you can actually finish and get that degree. What did you find?
Right. So I study schools where the graduation rates tend to be pretty high. And so the question is, we actually don't know how food and housing insecurity shapes academic performance and or graduation rates. So we are only beginning to open this kind of like Pandora's box to actually see if we can find out what is hurting students. Because we think that just because students are getting in and getting in under these conditions, that they're going to be okay. And then we realize like how many of these this hidden curriculum that students have to engage, these unset rules and unset and hidden expectations that trip students up. But they also have these official policies that they have to confront, like the closing of dining halls, that really does undercut their ability to be full functioning people. And so we're only now beginning to get a sense of how these problems are affecting students, which is why the GAO released their report looking at all the studies and all the surveys on food insecurity to actually see what we can do as a nation, as a national policy level, to fix this problem.
What do you say, though, to the skeptic who looks at your own personal story and says, but look, your own success shows that the hurdles must not be so bad, right? Because you got through Amherst. You're a Harvard professor now. You overcame all those hurdles.
Yeah, my story highlights more poverty than privilege, though. If you think about the ways in which it highlights just how many obstacles that one person has to overcome. It shouldn't be patting ourselves on the back saying, oh, look, this one person did it. It was just like, why are the obstacles so high? And look at how many other students did not do it, right? And so we have to look at how poverty and inequality shapes not only the path to college, but also the path through. And I hope that my research, even though I study the elites, pushes us to think about how education policy has to be about neighborhood inequality, has to be about school inequality before we even get to the post-secondary education aspects of it, because we've disinvested a lot in how we fund how we support our neighborhoods and how we support our schools.
Did you see peers who were just as gifted as you not make it through the way you did?
Yes, I think I'm the only person in my Head Start class, I think, who finished college, or at least went on.
You, in the book, use the sort of catch-all phrase renowned university, perhaps not to single out any one university, but you are focusing on sort of the upper echelon there. I'm curious, what is the reason for that? Because the other thing folks might wonder is, well, what about the students, you know, they're at state schools or they're at those middle-tier schools? Why overlook them?
I'm not overlooking them. I actually take time throughout the book to show how not only these problems are prevalent at our state colleges, regional colleges, and even community colleges, but I also want to show this. If I'm at a campus where they have removed money as a hurdle to entry, they have also removed like a lot of the things that push students to drop out, like working off campus and the like. If I'm showing that these problems exist in this environment, what do you think happens at a community college? What do you think happens at a state college where the resources are fewer and the attempts to be high touch in that way of working with students is not actually there because it can't be there? Like, those are the gaps. Like, I'm highlighting this at a place where you don't even expect it to be. Did you really expect food insecurity at a school like Yale and Harvard and Dartmouth and Smith and places like that? No. And so the fact that I'm highlighting it at these places hopefully draws attention to what is the reality at other campuses as well.
That's Anthony Jack. He's an assistant professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and a junior fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows. His new book is called The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. Professor Jack, thanks for being with us on Radio Boston.
All right, thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. a phone call, but give it a try. 617-917-4717.